Christian Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Voices whisper, ancient secrets, signs and symbols are abundant. UFOs, ETs, ghosts, and even the dead move about freely. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Welcome to the Mystical Underground. Thank you for joining us. This is Rob McGregor and
Trish McGregor.
And our producer and tech magician, John Posey. You can go to themysticalunderground.com where you can find where we make regular blog posts and where you can find out about our books. Among them are Phenomena, Harnessing Your Psychic Abilities, The Secrets of Spirit Communication, Sensing the Future, and Aliens in the Backyard. Our latest book is called Mind-Blowing Synchronicities, The Latest Science, Stories, and Research. Trisha's latest novel, White Crows. Rob's most recent novel is called Tulpas, a story of mysterious beings created through deep meditation. If you are watching us on YouTube, we would appreciate it if you would take a second to click the like, subscribe, and notification buttons so you never miss an episode. If you prefer to listen to the show, it is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe there.
Our guest today is Whitley Strieber, who began his writing career in the early 1980s with two great horror novels, The Wolfen and The Hunger. By the late 1980s, however, Whitley's career had literally moved into the Act Two Upside Down world with the publication of Communion in 1989 about his experiences with strange alien visitors, who he says came to his cabin in the New York State countryside. It was a number one bestseller on the New York Times list for 15 weeks. Since then, he's written several sequels to Communion, as well as other nonfiction and fiction titles. Now he's come out with The Fourth Mind, a new fascinating follow-up about what he has learned about the visitors over the years, and even recently about anatomical details that have been revealed. Welcome, Whitley. It's a pleasure to see you.
Welcome, Whitley.
Thank you both so much, Trish and Rob. It's a delight. And of course, their podcast appears on unknowncountry.com every week as well and is always worth listening to.
Okay, Whitley, The Fourth Mind might be your most unusual book. What led you to write it?
I don't know what led me to write
it. I was afraid you'd say something like that.
Suddenly it was there. What happened was I was sent a document by a friend that this individual had found on Reddit. And as soon as I read the document, I realized it was real. It is apparently written by a biologist who had direct access to the bodies that I personally have known were at Fort Detrick in Maryland for a long time. And I've seen these individuals, these beings, not the ones at Fort Detrick, I don't think, but members of the same species, if you will, many times, and have been in contact with them for now over 30 years. And I realized that I could compare my own observations to the anatomical descriptions in the document. And when I did that, I realized the document had to be real because there is, in fact, one thing that I haven't said to a soul, to one soul, to Bud Hopkins, who was disgusted by it and thought it was nonsense, never wrote about it. And yet here it is in the document. It's a very unusual thing about the visitors. So I thought the document is authentic, and that's what started the book. Then I got to thinking, why is it like this? Why can they levitate? Why can they move instantaneously from one place to another? Why are they so fast? Why can they self-heal, which I have seen happen? why, and why not us? And I set out to figure that out, and that's the journey of the second half of the book.
Yeah. So what's the meaning of the title, Fourth Mind?
The fourth mind, we have three minds. We have three levels of, the human being has three levels, the physical, the emotional, and the mental. And to some extent, but it's very nascent, the spiritual. The fourth mind sees the world from outside of the stream of time. We live inside the stream of time, and that's where we see the world. For us, every moment is always new. For our visitors, nothing is really new. They see the world from outside the stream of time. And I think that we can participate in this. I think the human mind was like this in the distant past, but isn't now.
That's interesting. It's you write a lot about the anatomy of the visitors from that document, and it seems that they are not very physically fit. That they don't really have much of a defense physically against humans, and it seems like they are just kind of weak beings physically. How would you explain that, or what do you think about that?
Well, when you're with them, you see how they are. They're very small and very fragile, but they can do all kinds of things with the mind, including make themselves look bigger. And some of them are about 5 feet tall, but the ones that were autopsied at Fort Detrick are about 4 feet tall, and they don't have genitals, and therefore they're not fully biological entities. They are engineered, perhaps highly sophisticated devices. But the interesting thing about them is that despite the fact that there's a lot of obvious engineering in their anatomy, they have very big brains with four lobes. We have the brainstem, the cerebellum, and the cerebrum, but they have four lobes in their brain, and three. So,
would that account for their ability to levitate and self-heal?
It's a good question. As we can levitate, as I show in the book, very clearly we can. I mean, I can't, and the two of you may or may not be able to. I'm not sure.
Not lately.
And, but there is enough evidence of this being an actual human ability that I don't think that it resides in one of the lobes. I think it's something else, and we have access to it too. Just like self-healing, I think we have access to that. I think we have maybe got access to a lot of different things that we don't actually use, including telepathy.
Well, I think humans, I think telepathy is easier for humans to use just because it just is.
I do telepathy all the time. It's not.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
It's not really a conscious thing either. I don't think it's kind of a, you think of somebody and it happens.
Well, I thought that Synchro Secrets had a lot of unspoken things to do with telepathy in it. It's a wonderful book, by the way, and I'd love to interview on Dreamland about it.
Willie, I was just going to say that more about the anatomy. In this document, they say they have no vocal cords. Does that mean they have no language then? They don't speak?
They don't have a spoken language.
Wow.
And their written language is obviously not like structured like a Phoenician or Greek or English. It's hieroglyphic. It's No, they don't have spoken language. They don't even, they can't even, they don't have a syrinx, so they can't even make noises as complex as those of birds, but I have heard the sounds they can make, and they are remarkable. First, of course, there are gasps, which are something that you will hear if you get too close to them unexpectedly or do something that they find threatening. But there are sounds, cries, that are marvelous to hear. I heard three of these cries uttered in sorrow. And they have stayed with me ever since I heard them. They were just remarkably deep and complex, but the most arresting thing about them in some ways was how perfectly spaced they were, how they were delivered with such precision that for a long time after I heard them, all music, and I'm a classical music fan, and I'm a great fan of Bach and Beethoven and composers who require a lot of very precise delivery. It all sounded, the best orchestras in the world sounded to me for months after I heard that sound.
Whitley, okay, when Anne passed away, did they comfort you? Did they,
She did. They didn't.
Okay, she did. Yeah.
Well, and back to
after she passed away, she nearly blew up your house.
Yeah, I know. That's true. Yeah. Our dog got freaked out.
Just real quick before we get too far away from the audible communication. Okay. Disembodied voice of John here. Is there any comparison to, would there be any comparison to the way whales appear to communicate and maybe even potentially some kind of connection there? Or?
And to add to that, do they have tongues?
I don't know if they have tongues. They suck. They drink. They do not have teeth. And if you do see teeth, which you do sometimes see, that's some kind of an appliance. They have a funny way of wanting to have hair and things that they want to look like us for some reason. Some of them do. And but that's neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned. They don't have, I don't think it's connected to the whales. Whales have very complex vocal cords and vocal systems. And this system is basically functions like a bird's, but without the syrinx, and they can just utter an, oh, that's about as complex as it can get, but they are not vocal. And because they aren't vocal, they are very fluently telepathic. And there's a podcast out called The Telepathy Tapes, which you may or may not be aware of, about unvoiced people in the autism spectrum who are fluently telepathic. And this has been proved by the research done by Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell. So
what?
We do have telepathy, and that's their basic way of communicating. When you're with them, you communicate telepathically.
Mm-hmm. So when you were saying you would hear a gasp or these when you say you were hearing them, actually you weren't hearing them with your ears, you were hearing them.
No, that's not correct. Sounds they make
are audible. Okay.
The gasps and the cries are audible sounds. And the cries are not long. They're about like that. The gasps, I've heard the gasps a couple of times when I've stumbled on them and they for whatever reason could not quickly get away. They're terrified of being with us in normal consciousness. They have a tremendous amount of difficulty handling that. They feel completely out of control in the presence of something that is enormous, intelligent, and unexpectedly aggressive.
I think they've proved to us that we do have telepathic abilities, because when they communicate telepathically to us and we pick it up. If we didn't have telepathic abilities, maybe we don't control it, but we wouldn't be able to hear anything from them, it would seem.
That's right. We do have telepathy. We definitely do. In fact, there are people working inside the government, according to what's beginning to come out on, like, from Ross Coulthart's show and so forth, who are what they call psionic, which they are, they sometimes, some of them I've heard called intuitives, who work with the visitors the same way I do. It's I work with them every night at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's all telepathic. That's how I write my books now.
And how come at 3 in the morning? Who chose that time?
They did.
They did.
And there turns out to be a reason for it that goes back deep in human tradition. It's not exactly 3 in the morning. It's an hour and a half before sunrise. Mm-hmm. It's called Brahma Muhurta time in yoga. And it is the time when the mind is most open influences from the outside. In other words, it's a time of day when telepathy is going to work best for a human mind.
And you meditate at that time as well, right? Or you have over the years?
I do. Ever since Annie passed away, she began to want me to wake up and meditate at that time. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing it ever since. If I don't do it for one night, that's okay. If I don't do it for 2 nights, the second night, there will be restlessness. If I don't do it for 3 nights, there's going to be a show of temper. And that is, I can tell you about some of those experiences. Let's put it this way. Whoever they are and whatever they are and however they connect with us and the dead and so forth, you don't want to make them mad.
Willie, you describe how they get rid of waste in their bodies. Tell us about that.
Well,
that was interesting.
That's the thing you learned about, right? That from the document.
Well, no. What happened was, I have known that for years.
Yeah.
And I have kept it to myself because it seemed so strange. I decided maybe that's just your imagination. But Hopkins was so grossed out by it. I thought, I don't want to tell enough strange stories. I'm leaving this one.
I gotta say this just so we can timestamp this. It's a Mystical Underground first. I don't think, I'm pretty sure we've never talked about alien waste on the podcast before. So this is the first. This is
and it grossed out Bud Hopkins. That's interesting.
Wait till you hear how they do it.
Okay. This was a long time ago. This must have been in probably 86 or 87. I had been trying hard to get them to interact with me. And they would disappear before my eyes. They were coming around the house all the time at that point. They weren't shy, except when you tried to engage with them. And then they would just, they were like birds. They'd just disappear. And I saw 3 of them in the front yard just at dawn, or just after dawn. And I thought, I'm going to go downstairs. I believe I was still in my pajamas. And it must have been, it was pretty cold, so it was probably spring, and no snow on the ground. And I thought, well, I went downstairs, and I looked out the front door, the screen of the front door, and they were still there. So I stepped out on the porch, and they were still there. So I stepped, they were up at the end of the yard in front of some little trees, and I stepped out into the yard, and they were still there. And I was being very careful. If you can imagine what you like to try to sneak up on a bird, that's exactly how. And so I didn't go much farther, maybe a few steps, so that I could see them clearly. And I wanted to talk to them. I was not really aware. I would have talked with my mouth at the time. I was very unsure about it. I was doing telepathy with them without knowing it. Let me put it that way, at that point in my life. So they were doing this, and pushing something off their bodies. And it was big sheets of something that was coming out of their skin. And I was thinking, what the hell is that? And then I could smell ammonia. It smelled like, it's what it smelled like. Not exactly like our urine, but a more ammonia-laden urine. And I thought, what in the world am I seeing here? And then I described this a week or so later to Bud, and he said, that you can't have seen anything like that, Whitley. Your imagination is running away with you. And so I thought, well, maybe so, but I sure remember it. And then I didn't say anything more about it because I didn't, you know, and then when the communion kerfluffle started, I certainly didn't talk about it on the air. I was having enough trouble fielding the rectal probe jokes. I didn't want to get any at all. So then the document comes along last year, and it explains that this is their, and I thought at the time that this was the way, in fact, I even told Bud that this was the way they excreted waste matter. And so the document comes along on Reddit, and there the whole thing is explained very carefully, exactly as I saw it. And I thought, this document has to be real. It has to be. Because I have not talked about this. I have not written about it to my knowledge anywhere. So, and it turns out they have a covering. And anyone who you talk to, close encounter witnesses you talk to, will say that they often, it looks like they're wearing a bodysuit. There's some kind of very tight covering. And they are. And it's part of their anatomy because these are not totally biological beings. They exude the waste in this way, and it's captured under this coat covering, which they will take off, I suppose, in certain circumstances. If you look closely at communion, you'll find that I mention somewhere seeing clothing lying on the floor and that the room was messy. And that, you know, I think that they had done that. I think they had taken some of the clothing off. Some of them had. In this, I've never been sure I was in a ship, but I was in a room somewhere, certainly, with them.
It's funny, when we met Bud Hopkins in 1987, when we were covering a UFO conference for Omni, and he and Betty Hill were two of the speakers. And I remember sitting next to Bud, and he goes, wow. Next year, there is a book coming out that is going to blow people's minds. It's going to be on the bestseller list. I said, who wrote it?
He wouldn't say.
Yeah. He said, I can't say that, but it's a famous author. And I thought, okay. Then a year later, Rob and I walk, or a couple years later, walk into a Walden's in the Fort Lauderdale Mall, and there's Communion. I thought, that's the book.
Right. Yeah.
That's great.
I got recruited, I guess.
Yeah. Whitley, have you met the writer of that document that you've...
Oh, I have no idea who it is.
Really?
I think it might be a violation. I'm not sure if it's a violation of the law or not, because the levels of... I know nothing about that. I've not tried to find the person. Anyway, how could I? You can't find it. You have to have the law behind you to find someone who's anonymous on Reddit. And this person is anonymous on Reddit.
It's strange that it's on Reddit, of all places. That's interesting.
You know, it's a logical place. A lot of people put UFO stuff on Reddit.
Yeah, that's true.
You mentioned the insect-like attributes, the grays. Can you expand on that part of their anatomy?
Yeah. Their anatomy is more like ours than like an insect's, but they have the ability to move very suddenly, and to be extremely still. They're like a praying mantis in that respect. A praying mantis can be very, very still and then move with great suddenness. When they're moving, when I've been with them, they move in a kind of a graceful way, and then they're on you, just like that. And they can also be so still that if they're moving, they become and instantaneously become completely still. They seem to disappear before your eyes, not because they've got some kind of technology, but because the brain stops processing them as moving and you don't see them anymore. They have to move before you see them. And they can stay still for a long, long time. And the result of this is that creatures with different brains, different setups in their brains can still see them. Not so much dogs, but cats, which are predators, stalking predators, can still see them. And so that's why when you people say, well, my cats can see them, that's what's happening.
Interesting.
And, you know, and our cats would be looking around the room and obviously see something that we couldn't see. And that was why, because they were very still.
Speaking of seeing, it's interesting that your book cover doesn't have the black eyes that the communion book cover has. It's like they have shed those black eyes, at least in the illustration.
Well, it mentions in the document, the Reddit document, that the black eyes are eye coverings.
Mm-hmm.
And I have memories of seeing them without those eye coverings, but they're not clear enough memories for without the Reddit document, I wouldn't have said that they didn't have eye coverings, that they could take them off. Mm-hmm. And because my memories are very indistinct. I talked to a friend about this, Steve Neal, and he's a close encounter witness who's on, you see him on the internet a lot on YouTube, an artist, and he says he remembers seeing them without the eye covering. So I think that is probably real. And my memory of this, although vague, is the intensity of, I can see it right now in my eye, my own mind's eye, the intensity of that face looking at me was very, very powerful. So I decided, given the document, given what Steve said, and given the way I have this vague memory, to go ahead and do that and see how people react to it.
Willie, when we met you for lunch in Casa Dega, I remember you describing the implant that you have. Is that still there?
It's right here.
I mean, and it still affects your vision?
It still sends words through my eye the same way it did then. And I still use it constantly in my writing. And it, for some interviews, it turns on. It's not on now, but it turn on for interviews and take over the interview completely. And I could just sleep and I'd just the interview.
That's convenient.
I was in an interview. And the implant was doing all the work and suddenly stopped. And I embarrassing situation of having absolutely no idea what we were talking about.
I
listen more carefully when it's doing that.
So it does feed you in your writing, you said.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't feed me exactly, like it doesn't tell me what to say.
Right.
There's a wonderful dialogue that goes on. I think the implant has a lot to do with Anne because she was such a muse when she was physically alive. And at one point, right after she died, after I had begun to see the slit, I was walking across the street and I could see the slit very clearly in the bright sunlight. And the words were racing past at breakneck speed. And I said, are you? And right in the middle of the street, I just stopped dead because it slows down and it says, it's me, Anne.
Oh, wow.
Starts asking again. Then I learned more about it. I've learned a lot about it. So if you want to talk about it a little bit more, I can go on.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Well, and real quick, just out of curiosity, have you ever heard Sammy Hagar talk about the fact that he thinks he has a implant?
No.
Okay. Anyways, but yeah, he believes he does, and he thinks that's where some of his music comes from. So interesting. Yeah. Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Wouldn't be surprised. Because mine is a real partner. I just love it.
So you wouldn't want it removed?
Oh, God, no. It's a video of the attempt to remove it on my website. And that removal attempt, thank God it failed, is all I can say. At the time, it had never done anything, and it bothered me. It made me nervous because I felt like I was being tracked, and Ann would say, who cares about where you go? Why didn't you go down to the 7-Eleven to buy a paper or a beer? And you don't do anything that anyone would want to track you about if they have a device that's been turned off for years. And she was right about that. I live a very mild life. I don't do anything particularly exciting except have interaction.
Yeah, you write about that the doctor who I think he was the one who attempted to remove it from you.
Yeah.
He also wrote a book about alien contact and particularly this
Dr. Lear.
Yeah, I think that was it. The story takes place in Brazil of Varginha or something
that. This is a little mixed up. The doctor who tried to remove it is not Dr. Roger Lear.
Okay.
And he wouldn't let me get near Roger because Roger knew how to get him out. And she knew that. And so when I insisted that I wanted to try, she made sure I ended up with a doctor. I had no idea what he was doing, and he failed. He touched it with his scalpel. It went down into my earlobe. And he was pretty shocked by that because he thought he was taking out a cyst, but he knew I'd written communion. And when that happened, he realized, hell, I'm not trying to take out a cyst. And I'm getting out of here. He up and got out of there. But Dr. Roger Lear went down to Varginha.
Okay.
Varginha. And in this book, The Fourth Mind is dedicated to Roger. It's dedicated to Roger because he is he was an unsung hero. And like so many people in the UFO world, he's been buried. And yet he did absolutely pioneering work on implants that one day will be very important. He will be a historical figure in time, but in my case, I knew him, and when he was he was going down to Varginha, and he called me and said, you should come with me, and I couldn't do it because I didn't have time, and so he went down there by himself. He calls me, and he comes back. He says, it's the most important of all UFO cases, and John Mack had told me the same thing about the aerial school, the school in Zimbabwe. So I'd heard that before, and I said, well, why is it so important? And he said, well, I talked to some doctors who did set the leg, broken leg of an alien. And he said, I've got an interview with them on tape. Wow. And that interview turns up in his book on Varginha. And it is a remarkable interview. And in the interview, there is something that forms the centerpiece of The Fourth Mind, and I think is one of the most important moments in the whole experience of contact. These doctors observe this being heal itself with a kind of green mist that comes around it. And it says to them telepathically that his people, its people, are sorry for us, feel sorry for us, because we lost these powers, like telepathy and self-healing and things like that. Not that we don't have them, but that we're crippled. We don't use them. And the book asks the question, why not? Why did we lose them? And to do that, to understand that answer to that question, you have to go back 12,000 years.
Wow.
The worst thing that ever happened to mankind, in at least in the past 50,000 years, certainly. And that was the a geologic period that's called the Younger Dryas, where, among other things, and this is all geology, I'm not speculating about anything here, the entire North American continent burned.
Burned.
Then the Laurentide Glacier melted and flooded the continent from a couple of hundred miles east of the Rockies, almost all to a couple of hundred miles east of the Mississippi River.
Jeez.
The whole continent was flooded for 1,000 years. In that, every single human being, all of the large ungulates, the large animals, the ground sloths, the mammoths, the mastodons, the predator animals, were eradicated from North America. The horses, everything. The entire human population east of the Rockies. And the continent was left devastated. And only slowly did it come back. Meanwhile, in the rest of the world, this is where all of our stories of wars in space, wars in, among the gods, come from. Because what was happening was, 30,000 years ago, there was a supernova in relatively close to Earth. Then 12,000 years ago, the physical debris from that supernova came sweeping through the solar system. It started impacting the sun, the outer planets, the inner planets. there are mammoth bones found with tiny pieces of meteoric iron embedded in their bones, because they were literally sheeted with these ultra high speed, high energy particles that came in with the cloud of debris from this supernova and died on the spot. You find some of them in Alaska, which have been preserved because of the nature of the tundra and so forth there, with food still in their mouths, because they literally dropped dead. Literally dropped dead because of this. The human population was decimated. The continent was set on fire. Bolides hit the Laurentide Glacier, causing backsplash that splashed ice, chunks of ice, huge chunks of ice, all the way back into the Carolinas, causing what's known as the Carolina Dells, which are thousands of little craters in the Carolinas, which have nothing in them. In other words, they were caused by ice, and the ice then melted. There's evidence of huge blocks of ice hitting in different places in New Mexico. It was that violent. And around the world, this violence was seen in the skies. As the sun is very sensitive to objects striking it. And the result of this was that there was one huge solar flare and coronal mass ejection after another. And the sky was filled for 1,000 years with displays of auroral intensity unlike anything we have ever known. And huge solar flares were routine. And people were trying to live in this. The Younger Dryas was basically caused by the smoke from the fires, from the forest fires around the world, and particularly concentrated in North America. The planet was covered with a pall of smoke for years and years and years. The human population, along with the population of many other animals, plummeted. Prior to that, I go across this very carefully in the book. There were things that we could do. If you look at the fortress at Sacsahuaman in Peru, if you look at Nan Madol in the Carolinas, well, let's talk about Nan Madol a little bit. Nan Madol is in the Carolinas, in the way in the South Pacific. It's an abandoned group of artificial islands made of 750,000 basalt logs, each of them weighing many, many tons. Now, the National Geographic went to investigate this a few years ago, and to their credit, I believe they've taken this off their website. And they decided it had been built by the Polynesians because they found a fire pit that where the carbon dated to the 12th century. Now, it was pointed out, I think, by a number of nautical engineers that the Polynesians didn't have any boats that would carry a 750,000 multi-ton blocks of basalt from a quarry, which is found. It's not far from the islands. But now we don't know what was done. But the book goes into that. It goes into this gigantic platform at Baalbek in Lebanon with 100-plus ton stones in it. The archaeologists say, oh, the Romans did it. They moved the stones. But the Romans didn't. Roman cranes, which we know a good bit about, could lift as much as maybe 40 tons, not 1,000 tons, not even close. And who carved them? A lot of this was done with the mind. And I then fast forward into the present to a man called Ed Leedskalnin, who built something you've probably seen, the Coral Castle.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Several times.
In secret. No one ever saw him move any of the stones, and he didn't have any cranes or tools.
Oh, that's true.
He said that he had an ancient Egyptian secret that enabled him to move those stones, and he died with that secret.
Ed was also about 5'1" tall and weighed 110 pounds, something like that. So he's a small man.
So there's something up here that enables us to do these things. I have a friend, or had a friend, he passed away, who was the assistant when he was a novice in the Catholic Church, a young upcoming priest. He didn't stay in the church. Paul Eno, he was attached to assist an exorcist, the diocesan exorcist. They went into a mental institution at the request of a family that wanted their daughter. They try and exorcism on their daughter, who had schizophrenia and drug addiction and was really in a very bad way. 17-year-old girl, and of course their parents were just desperate to save their poor kid. And this is the situation. The daughter is sitting in a room in the hospital in a wheelchair. The exorcist is there. There is Paul and another assistant, a psychiatrist, and two psychiatric nurses from the hospital and all around this girl. Suddenly, in the middle of the exorcism, still in a sitting position, the girl comes floating up out of the chair.
Oh, wow.
And the exorcist says very quietly to Paul, just push her back down. He goes and he pushes her back down into the chair. And I go into detail about this, exactly what he felt in his hands, what was happening, because, and I go into detail also about what had to happen to the girl's body, what had to change in the body to make it lighter than air. It's a remarkable story, but it doesn't end there. That's only part of it. That's only a witness experience from the present. There's another book called by Carlos M. N. Iyer called They Flew, which goes into all of the evidence of levitation in the Middle Ages. And I explain why these are real, these stories, because they aren't just anecdotal of someone said, oh, I heard that, I saw it. Or thousands of people would see these incidents taking place. Thousands of them would see this. And at one point, Joseph of Cupertino, who was probably the most fluent levitator who ever lived, was taken to see the Pope. And in a crowded audience with the Pope, with hundreds of prelates around, he bent down to kiss the feet of the Pope, and he was a religious ecstatic of the first intensity. And instead of kissing the feet, he shot up into the air in front of all those people, including the Pope. And the astonishing them all, because you don't see that very often.
Ever.
Yeah.
And
but it seems to happen more often in India. Why is that? Cases of bilocation.
Well, that's true. There are many, many more cases in India than in the West. Mm-hmm. And it's because of a different mindset. Mm-hmm. In the West, it happened in the Middle Ages and died out because religious ecstasy died out too. The last religious ecstatic to do this before witnesses was Padre Pio, who died in 1963 in Italy, and who incidentally converted General Nathan Twining to Catholicism after General Twining witnessed him doing this. That's a family story, but it's not in the, certainly not in the Air Force's description of General Twining that you'll find on Wikipedia at all. It happened anyway, and that's why General Twining became a Catholic. And also when he started a long tradition in the Air Materiel Command, General Twining was head of the Air Materiel Command when my Uncle Mickey was attached to Air Materiel and his friend Arthur Exon during the Roswell incident. So, subsequently, all of the heads of Air Materiel have had a strong religious connection of some kind.
Why would ecstasy like that cause you to levitate?
What? We don't know. I wish I could answer that question.
I've got another question, Whitley. What advantages would full contact with visitors have for humanity, and what advantages would it have for the visitors?
Well, that's a big part of the book. A big part of the book, because this is going to happen. And right now it's being filtered through the authorities, the very same authorities who have kept this secret for 80 years and lied about, through their teeth about it to us, are now supposed to turn around and tell us the truth. And we're supposed to believe whatever they tell us. And that's already happening. You'll find them, the people who are so-called whistleblowers, coming out all over the place saying, well, I'm going to tell my story now. But what is really happening, I don't know. I do know this. Unless this emerges in among the people, it's really not going to emerge at all. Mm-hmm. If the existing social structure and political structure tries to maintain control of this, it will fail. And it will fail in very profound ways that are extremely deleterious to our lives and our future. It has to be one-on-one between us and them. And this is because it gets right back to the title, my Annie, or oops, my aunt back there, shows for communion, that word, communion. I'm in communion with the visitors. I live in that state. It is, there's a man who was just on Ross Coulthart. His name's not coming to mind. Who was an operator in special forces, I believe, who transported one of the devices. And I told these people years ago, when you're looking at the materials, they're looking back at you, because these are not machines like we make. They are ensouled devices. And he had the experience of the soul in the device coming into him. And he says in the interview with Coulthart that it's possession. And I thought to myself, this is the mistake. This is the fundamental mistake. And I wrote Ross a letter about it, explaining exactly why it is a mistake. I might receive a response. That's not impossible. But that's what's going to happen. They're going to say that it's okay to be possessed by this, and it's not okay. Sharing of being is okay, but you have to work hard at it. It's not easy. Right now, it took me a long time to get to the point where at that 3 a.m. meeting, when the visitors come into my body, there's a sharing, not a taking. They do not possess me. They share my experience of time, and I share their knowledge. That's how it works. But you don't want a situation where they share your experience of time and they take it. They take your experience, so that when you die, you are like a Swiss cheese. You've had experiences taken from you, and you don't have your full life or any of it. In some cases, they can be very predatory in that sense, and in ways that we don't even understand.
Yeah, you never use the word vampire, but there are some vampire type attributes. For example, they seem to need a certain element of blood, cattle blood in particular, copper, for their nutrition, and which would explain the cattle mutilations. Yes. And then the other part about taking our memories away would be another type of vampirism.
Well, but I don't think that we can characterize the cattle mutilations as vampirism. They eat blood in the same way we eat meat. Yeah. And you have poor cattle, they get it from both ends because.
Right.
Yeah. Either way, they're screwed.
And they chose cattle because they have a high copper content, and their blood is just right for the visitor's nutrition, just as the meat is just right for our nutrition. And so they will take the cattle. I have to tell you that the human body produces a blood that is maybe in some ways even more perfect for the visitor's nutrition, but you don't see them eating us. And the reason being that they don't want to get into a fight with us because, you know, taking us and eating us and leaving us lying around like they do the cow.
Yeah.
That's an act of aggression.
Yeah. Well, my full thesis about this, this concept was that maybe they came to you because of the hunger and the relationship.
I haven't thought of that. It's fascinating. I want to play with that idea.
Okay.
But you know, if you look back at those first two novels, The Hunger and The Wolfen, they have the Wolfen are the grays.
Uh-huh.
And the Nordics are the hunger, are the tall, pale being in the hunger. And you know, I've the grays are very predatory by nature, just like us. We're predators too. The Nordic I met one of them. And he was definitely not of this world. There was no question about it. I don't want to get into any details about the meeting for various reasons, but he was, I don't think he was a predator, but I do feel that when I was writing those books, I knew something inside myself. There's even a passage in The Wolfen of this big, these one of the Wolfen coming to a window of a cabin near New Paltz, New York.
Uh-huh.
This was long before we bought the cabin, and that happened years and years ago. So, you know, that's pretty mysterious.
Well, that's precognitive. That happens a lot, I think, with fiction writers.
Cognitive level, even uh-huh. then, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But not uh-huh.
consciously. Mm-hmm. Whitley, how do you live day to day with all of this knowledge and this awareness of visitors? And I mean, do you ever feel like you're losing your mind?
No, I don't feel like I'm losing my mind at all. I have a very efficient mind, mm-hmm. and not even close to losing it. I never have been. I'm frustrated now because I'm being ghosted. I sent advanced reading copies of my book out to all kinds of friends that are deep into this. Sal Pudoff, Diana Pasulka, Gary Nolan, and Jacques Vallée, and people like that. Chris Mellon, whom I've known for a long time. I don't know Chris very well, but I know the others quite well. I've had dinner with Chris once.
How about Peter Lavenda?
No, I didn't send it to him.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't, because he so never replies to me about anything.
Same with
same
us.
Same here.
So, not a peep.
Really? But this one book is fantastic.
Jeff Kripal. And the other, and I sent them the book, them, they all were excited and saying, oh, I'm so glad to get it. I'll read it immediately. Not a peep. And that's because the government is in the background trying to take this over.
Jeez.
People. And I represent the people, the common man's relationship with the visitors, and they now want nothing to do with it.
Jeez. So these people are being influenced by the government not to have anything to do with you.
I don't know how it works. But they, yes. And I did a big podcast with Jesse Michaels. And he was a huge podcast. And when I left the room, he said, oh, we're gonna run this on January the 15th. And that was the day my book was coming out. It didn't run. And I got an email from him today. I asked him why. And he says, oh, it's going to run in the next few months. After the book is, it's no longer useful in promoting the book.
Wow. Right.
Somebody did that. That's not. Jesse didn't do it. Jesse was either told to do it or it's mind control. I don't know which.
Jeez. But
someone is working very hard to crush this book.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to leave a great review. I love the book.
Oh, anyone who hears this, please do review it on Amazon.
Yeah.
It's the only chance I have. I am getting a few shows, good shows. Mm-hmm. I have to say I am, mm-hmm. but not nearly the number that I used to get.
Yeah. Wow. So Whitley, those names that you mentioned just a minute ago, they all, I believe, are associated with the To the Stars Institute or whatever the full name is.
Yes.
I haven't heard much about them lately. Are they still active in that?
I don't know. I had breakfast with Hal Pudoff a couple of months ago. We've been friends a long time. Well, that doesn't mean he's going to help me.
Wow.
But
it sucks, Whitley. If you've known somebody for years and they're not going to help.
I ought to have blurbs from Gary. I ought to have a blurb.
Yeah.
I ought to have blurbs from quite a few, from Jacques, certainly. I have been friends with Jacques for years, and not even a reply, not a
wow.
Maybe it's that the document is... that they don't trust.
Oh, come on. But Whitley's the author of the book. That's what he's talking about.
And a large part of it is based on that document on the internet. But
yeah, but if they read the book, they can see perfectly clearly that the document is correct.
Yeah.
I'm an efficient researcher, and the genetics that I go into in the book are correct, and they do reflect the genetics that are described in the document.
That's interesting, yeah.
That is.
Well, Whitley, it's been our hours
it's
about
been
up.
Great.
That is great. Thank you for spending an hour with us. We really enjoy talking with you every time we do. And
thanks for joining The Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening, and stay mystical.